Today is June 14th, 2023. I'm David Caruso, sitting here for our second session with Tim and Sue Krogan as part of the oral history interview that we're conducting here at the Science History Institute. Yesterday, we wrapped up with you finishing graduate school. We heard a little bit about your relationship. I know that you wound up coming out to, Sue, I know you came out to LSU in 84. Mm-hmm. But Tim, you started there in 1981. Mm-hmm. After being hired, after you mentioned a little bit what it was like visiting LSU and the change in culture there, what people were like. I am interested to know more what it was like for you getting to the institution and starting up your research there. You mentioned that you know you were being given your own lab. You were given the freedom to think about the research that you wanted to undertake. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to know, what was it like for you, like on that first, well, maybe not the first day, mm-hmm. but those first days when you are now a member of the LSU Rice Research Station. Mm-hmm. If you could tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, when I arrived, pleasantly presented with the opportunity to build this new lab, so and also equip it. Mm-hmm. So that was a real opportunity to make things the way I wanted it. And with the experience at Davis, I had some pretty solid ideas on what we needed in the facility. Mm-hmm. And there didn't seem to be any shortage of funding for doing that, and that worked out very well. So
what were some of the things that you felt you needed in order to set up your lab? Were there specific technologies that devices, mass spec devices, chromatographs, anything like that you felt that the lab needed to be equipped with that they didn't have that you wanted to purchase?
Not elaborate pieces of equipment, things mm-hmm. like sterile transfer hoods,
okay.
To have the opportunity to handle the cultures and not get them contaminated by other organisms. There wasn't really any really exceptional pieces of equipment.
Autoclave.
Yeah, autoclave.
Purification.
Yeah, that was sort of standard equipment for this kind of work, though.
Okay. And the incubators.
Incubators, right.
Okay, so just the standard basic equipment that you would need.
But they did have the funding for all of that, mm-hmm. so didn't have to wrestle around with them about whether or not we should get it. Mm-hmm.
And what was the physical size of your lab?
It was large.
Yeah, geez.
What would you say that is? I would say it was like...
Because at one point we had like 20 people.
Yeah. Maybe three times the size of this room.
Three times the size of this room.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
And how many benches or laboratory? How many hoods did you wind up having?
Three or four hoods.
Four. Okay.
Right.
And when you started setting up your lab, how long did it take you to do that initial setup of your lab? Was it relatively rapid?
Well, I communicated with them beforehand.
Okay.
So kind of took that into account that we wanted to hit the ground running. Mm-hmm. So I would send them a list of what was needed in the facility, and without question, they just went ahead and provided everything I asked for. So that was cool.
And when you showed up, was everything unboxed and placed in various positions around the lab, or did you have to? Okay.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, so the layout was kind of set up for you.
Yes. Exactly.
They already had hired him too.
Two technicians.
Okay, that was going to be my next question: is who is going to who is staffing your lab when you got there? You had two technicians coming in.
Yeah, they were at ground zero, so they needed to learn everything mm-hmm. you know, that we were going to be doing. But that was easy to do. They were enthusiastic.
Do you remember their histories? Had they been technicians before? Were they just people from the community?
Do you remember that?
I think Mona had been working there in some other lab. Doing
more
just traditional
like seed counting mm-hmm. things, not very high tech.
Okay.
Nothing very high tech.
So you come in, you have the physical space set up, you have the equipment that you need, you have two technicians.
Yes.
Did you immediately start to develop a specific research project, or did you feel that you needed more people on site? Because Sue, you mentioned that at some point you had like 20 people in there. So I'm wondering, did the lab grow in terms of personnel quickly, or was that a slow growth over time as you were doing more work?
Do you remember that?
I would say a little bit of a slow growth, but by the time I got there in 84 and brought on my group of people, you know, his was pretty blowing and going, because it was 3 years later.
Right.
So his was, within that first 3 years, it kind of picked up pretty quickly.
Yeah, it got up to speed for sure.
Okay, so pretty quickly. So three years, you were pretty much up to speed on research project, more people in the lab, more people doing work.
Yeah, it was a very active lab.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the things that they did, though, the individual who hired, actually both of us, Duke Faulkner, he was in charge of the Rice Research Station, and he was very internationally known. He had worked, was it the Ford Foundation in India or something?
Yeah, he'd gone to India.
He had traveled quite a bit. So one of the first things he did, which I was impressed with, is he told Tim, he says, you need to get out and see the world and how rice is grown, and sent him literally around the world.
Around the world.
He went from Louisiana, I don't remember how many stops, but I know there was India and Thailand and the Philippines, and then kind of circled around and end up, before he went back to Louisiana, stopping in California again. And the reason I remember this so strongly is he had gotten a little black lab, and I took the, while he was gone on this month trip, took the lab to California and took care of him while he was on this whirlwind trip.
Yeah, that was a wonderful opportunity, you know, to see the other parts of the world and how rice was grown and what their needs were and what the people that working in rice were like, you know,
and
get to
how
know
poor
them.
People were that were dependent on the rice.
Yes, exactly.
So was Duke Faulkner a plant scientist as well, or?
He was an engineer.
He's an engineer.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, he was.
But very bright individual.
Yes.
Very firm.
Yeah.
But very honest. And if you could, his first comment was usually no, but if you gave a good argument, he would say, okay.
Yeah.
And but he made you, you know.
Yeah, he's kind of a tough old guy, but he had good goals.
Mm. So in this around the world trip, you mentioned India, China?
That was the next trip he took, went to China.
Okay, so let's stay focused on this first trip. You're going around the world, you're meeting individuals who are growers, or are you also meeting with people who work on breeding rice?
Breeding, mostly.
Oh, mostly breeders.
Yes.
Were these like large commercial farming type of breeders, or was it like I have a decent size?
It was major operations, so it was. I'd go to institutes similar to where we were working.
Okay.
So
wasn't it like CIMMYT? I'm trying to remember all the acronyms.
Yeah.
All the different international research centers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the India was actually a conference as well.
Yes.
Some kind of rice conference.
Yeah.
And so while you're making this trip, do you recall what you were learning from all these different institutes in terms of how they were approaching rice science and how they were approaching problems like feeding individuals?
Yeah. Not so much. I think this real function of the traveling like that was just get exposed to the role of rice in other countries, and you know, to talk to the guys who were working on rice in their locations. It was quite eye opening to me. You know, I didn't very much about that kind of stuff.
In terms of the general science that individuals were pursuing at this period of time, was there a broad focus? Was it looking to improve the stalk strength, right, so things don't break? Was it looking to improve productivity of individual plants? What were people thinking about broadly at the time in terms of rice and its production?
Well, pretty standard, just to increase the amount of rice that was produced on a amount of land. Mm-hmm. The main goal was to increase yields. So they weren't so oriented at developing, you know, particularly brand new kinds of rice.
Okay.
They mostly wanted just.
It's kind of the green, what they called the green revolution.
Right.
It was increasing yields, and but then you realize what are the limitations when you have an acre. You know, is it water, labor, or what are the things that restrict? You know, the weeds, the pests, and that type of stuff. And what's mind-boggling is the percent that weeds actually, because you're watering and fertilizing these plants that you're growing, but the weeds are benefiting.
Yeah, you're watering and fertilizing the weeds at the same time.
And they actually can outcompete a lot of the crops. So those weeds are actually a pretty significant hindrance to increasing yields.
I agree with that totally.
And do you know what some of the approaches were at the time for trying to deal with those problems? Like what?
A lot of just bend over hand pulling.
Okay.
Well,
you could describe how they did it in Louisiana in terms of controlling the red rice. There was a whole process.
What do you mean, like roguing the fields?
Well, red rice is very similar to commercial rice.
Yeah, same genus and species.
And so if you were growing a crop of soybeans, there are certain herbicides you could spray that would kill, say, the red rice and other weeds, and the soybeans would be fine. But in a rice field, you couldn't do that. So not only red rice being a significant problem, but other weeds. So to control this red rice, they came up with all these things where they would have to pretty much aerial seed the rice versus drill seeding, because you would put the water on that would kind of help suppress things. They did, what they call it, muddying in. And then they would always be rotating with soybeans, even though soybeans weren't real economic in the rice growing areas of Louisiana, were not very profitable. It was the only way you could get on top of controlling that particular weed, which was very...
So you'd alternate rice and soybeans, and during the soybean crop, you tried to knock the red rice down.
Okay.
And hold that, and kind of keep that under control, and then you can go back to the rice crop next year.
Red rice is, when it grows, it's very aggressive. But what happens is they call it shattering. The grains do not stay on the head, so they drop into the field, which just replenishes
it. So they contaminate the field.
Right.
And they can stay dormant for quite some time. So they can go a couple years in the soil and then germinate. And then the problem is when you go to harvest your rice, you have this red rice which is contaminating the rice. Now, red rice is actually grown in other parts of the world and eaten, but the U.S. rice industry, they don't want
the presence.
They want to
colored
look
rice
at a bag and see all these perfect grains.
Right.
So if you have this grain that's different in there, the quality is lower and stuff. And then the millers, in order to get rid of the red rice, have to go through a lot more rigorous cleaning up. And so the quality, you know, you bring in a truckload of rice, what you get out at the other end, you've got not as much as you should because there's brokens. And
how much you got paid for the rice was dependent a lot on how much red rice was in the load.
So the red rice itself, you said other countries, other places do eat red rice. Is its nutritional value different significantly from non-red rice?
Boy, It's probably similar. I don't remember this.
It wasn't like it was inedible or anything like that. It wasn't, you know, bad for you. But it was just the presence of this contaminant in your bag of rice, which is eye-catching.
So it sounds like it was more aesthetic
than anything else.
So it wasn't that it was bad to have
the
red rice. It was just that you wanted to see a bag of white rice, not a bag. What's the candy? Good. Is it Good and Plenty? That's the white end. So you didn't want like the Good and Plenty version of rice. You just wanted it to be white.
And what they call broken. So, you know, if you have a sack of long grain rice, you want each kernel to be there. You don't want it to be what they call broken. They want it to be a whole kernel. So
the red rice tended to
fracture. If you had to mill it more to get the you know,
they tried to get that red coating off by milling it more, and that would break up more of the rice, which lowered the value.
Right. And then certain industries, you know, Budweiser and who's the one that does Special K, you know, the people that are using rice in food products also had pretty high standards. And I think just the U.S., the quality of U.S. rice compared to other places in the world. Now, I know Japan has very high standards for their rice stuff, but when you're just producing rice to feed people, they don't care. It's just volume. They don't care the quality.
Right.
Okay. And just to make sure that I understand the process correctly, so the planting of soybeans, it wasn't about this. I mean, you could make some money off the soybeans, but it really wasn't about that. It was planting something that wouldn't die when you sprayed an herbicide to kill essentially the red rice, so that way hopefully when you then went and planted the standard commercial rice again, there wouldn't be as much red rice because you might have killed it in the interim. You also mentioned that the red rice could lay dormant for years and then begin sprouting.
Many years, yes.
If you sprayed with an herbicide, was that dormant rice also killed, or is it only? So I was like,
it depends on the mode of action of the herbicide.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So it might have killed some of the dormant ones, but it may have just been like, well, you killed what you killed, but whatever went in ground and remained dormant, it was going to pop up.
Things like Roundup are contact. So, you know, they kill what they touch. Other herbicides you would put on the ground would kill germinating seeds. So it just kind of, again, was the mode of action of the
herbicide.
Okay. In when you were visiting these various institutes, were they looking for, I'm going to use this word here, and I don't know if it's appropriate, but were they looking for natural ways to modify things to get things, to have the rice be more productive? And I'm using the word natural here because I know that genetically modified, and you were talking about the biotech revolution beginning in the 1970s. So I'm curious to know if people were starting to think about genetically modifying organisms in the early 1980s. And so that's why I was trying to use the word natural as compared to genetically modified.
Right. Yeah. I don't think that was in the picture that.
Okay. So no genetically modified.
Just traditional breeding.
All right. So you spent a month traveling the world, learning about. And was this your first international travel? Was this the first time you're outside the United States?
I guess maybe I had been to Mexico or something
but not
to that extent.
Okay, so you got a lot of stamps on your passport.
That's for sure.
In experiencing or going to these other institutes and being in these other countries. You had mentioned yesterday the fact that you decided to move into this field because, you know, the thought that, you know, kids couldn't eat, that people were starving. Mm-hmm. You felt this desire to address that problem. Mm-hmm. When you were visiting these other institutes in these other countries, do you recall any experiences with regard to that specific aspect of things, like seeing the poverty, seeing starvation internationally that maybe you hadn't been exposed to in the U.S.
Especially like in India and stuff like that, you'd see considerable. That was a predominant thing. Mm-hmm. People were just skinny people, you know. You could tell they were undernourished. Mm-hmm. And the worst part was that the babies were the ones they had to sacrifice. You know, the mom and dad couldn't be kept from eating. They had to be out there to do the work on the rice field, mm-hmm. or everybody died. So.
And I'm trying to remember. Is it the early 1980s? I'm like now flashing back to commercials on television. Where was it? Ethiopia that was going through a food crisis? Because I remember like the ads on TV, like donating certain amount of money per day helps feed a child. And I remember Ethiopia specifically, but it may have been other countries as well.
Yeah, don't know specifically on that. The answer to that.
Okay.
But I think it was occurring somewhere.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Every year.
Every year.
Every year.
Yeah.
So you have this month-long trip. I assume you pick up the black lab on your way back to Louisiana.
Yep.
You return to your lab. You have the two technicians. You have the equipment. What project do you decide to focus on in those early years of your time at the LSU Rice Research Station?
So I knew I should have brought my notes. So I went through our annual reports, because every year we had to write our annual report. And so I went by year what he reported on, mm-hmm. and stuff. So coming up with something weed resistant was kind of, you identified as like a number one thing. And then there's kind of a separate project, which we can talk about, which was anthiculture, which is a way of taking breeding lines, and when you come up with a new variety, it takes years to get that variety to the point where you can commercialize it. And anthiculture is a way to kind of shorten that. So, but coming back to the herbicide, that was kind of the focus. And what was interesting is, based on your annual reports, Tim Wood took several approaches, and one of them was screening the world collection of rice plants. Mm-hmm. Remember all that? And every year there was a individual there, a pathologist, who would every year get, I can't remember the number, but say 200 or 2,000 lines, and he would plant them, and he was looking for disease resistance. So Tim was working with him and getting these lines, and literally planting rows and rows and rows of the world collection, and then spraying them for herbicide and looking to
hoping see. That one of them would turn out to be resistant,
right,
to
just
the herbicide.
Just a particular world collection. And then and then you started with doing semiclonal
variation.
Yeah. So that was your first kind of approach.
Yeah, that's in cell culture. Lots of times you would grow the tissues, and if you could cause them to regenerate back into a plant to form a plant, and sometimes those would have novel new characteristics. So that I looked for plants that had herbicide resistance as a new characteristic, but that didn't pan out.
So he would regenerate plants, put them out in the field. You look for things that they were looking for, varieties that were shorter, because you mentioned, about standing up for the lodging.
Yeah, there's other
characters. So he was looking for new traits in these semiclones, but one of them was the for the herbicide resistance. So he was kind of looking at different approaches to come up with a herbicide resistant. But there was a process too that you went through on trying different herbicides too,
right,
as to what would be the right herbicide to select for.
Right.
And can you tell me a little bit about that process?
Well, there's a lot of herbicides they couldn't use on rice because it would kill the rice. So, mm-hmm. But they were good herbicides, so I had to get very familiar with all these other herbicides that normally weren't used in rice production. And but would be useful if you could go out there and spray it and kill the red rice, mm-hmm. and not kill the commercial rice.
So I have a certain image in my mind of this overall process, and I just want to make sure that I'm understanding it correctly. So you do this work, there's some laboratory work where you're trying to analyze and grow seeds and have them become new plants. You then mm-hmm. take these mm-hmm. Seeds, plants, you put them out in a field, you plant them, and then as they're growing, you spray certain sections of the field with certain herbicides, or is it like you have different fields and like this field, I'm going to spray it with this herbicide, this field I'm going to spray with
it
that.
It was more this field than that field because the herbicide tends to drift with wet, with wind.
Okay.
So you didn't want to complicate things with that, so you'd put them in separate fields.
Separate fields. Okay.
And so one of the interesting things was most of the projects were in the field and that during the growing season, and then they didn't really do much in the wintertime because it was mostly in the field. Where Tim's project, it was like, say, in the wintertime, you're trying to produce as many somaclones as you can, you're growing them up in the greenhouse, collecting seeds, stuff like that, and then the growing season, you're out in the field, planting, spraying, harvesting, and then coming back. So it was a year-round effort.
Operation.
Yeah. And then one of the other techniques you were doing was taking seeds and soaking them in herbicides and then planting them. So he had all these different techniques he was
different
trying.
Approaches.
And do you recall what inspired your different approaches? Like I would never think to myself, oh, maybe we should soak some seeds in herbicide and see what happens. Do you recall what made you think of these different ways of experimenting?
Just trying to try everything possible.
Mm.
Brainstorm, maybe we haven't tried this, let's mm-hmm. try this. Let's see if there's anything.
One thing, if you're selecting for disease resistance, you have to grow a plant, introduce the disease, and if it survives. One thing about herbicide resistance is
you spray it.
You spray it. It either lives or it dies.
Yeah.
So
it's pretty black and white.
Mm-hmm. And so things varied by season, right? So when you're in the growing season, you're trying to kill stuff. when you're not in the growing season, you're trying to grow stuff that you could then grow in the growing season. How large were the fields that you were planting in?
Large.
20 acres?
20 acres.
20, 30,
okay.
Maybe even 40 acres.
And were you the one going out and poking holes in the ground and putting in seeds?
Well, we had equipment, so mm-hmm. we could plant with the equipment, and then we could also use the equipment to spray.
Okay.
So, but I was one out spraying it.
You were on the tractor.
On the tractor, right.
You were on the tractor. And right. So the technicians that you had, were they just laboratory technicians, or were they out in the field as well?
They were more laboratory than...
But then you got some guys later, like you had somebody before Ronald Reagan,
Hi, Dave. Reception just called.
All right. So, I'd like to hear a little bit more about that early work. You mentioned the spraying, and you were out in the field. What I'm curious to know is, as you are out in the field and you're doing this work, I know later on you had other people to help you. When you were spraying these herbicides, were you were you wearing hazmat suits? Were you, cause I think about what I did in the early 80s, like when we sprayed for like weeds and things like that, like we weren't wearing it. Like it wasn't DDT level spraying myself,
right.
But
right.
I was getting hit with herbicides while I was spraying outside. I was wondering if you were taking any precautions to protect yourself or.
I don't think so.
Nope.
No. So inhaling, like if the wind was bad that day, you were sniffing some herbicides?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he typically would go out real early in the morning before the wind.
Before the wind picked up.
In Louisiana, mm-hmm. it's real interesting. You go at daybreak and it's real calm and still. And then that's always a good time to get out there.
Yeah. Also, you got a uniform spray pattern if the wind wasn't blowing.
Okay.
If it was blowing, you might miss a spot. You might get a plant that survived. You get all excited about it. Well, it's just because the wind blew the herbicide
mm-hmm.
Past it.
Okay.
In a burst of wind.
And so was that a kind of standard thing that you did every morning in the growing season? Were you out spraying herbicides every day, or is it that there was you would spray once and then you'd see what would happen? What was the overall process like?
What do you think? I was spraying pretty regularly.
Yeah. I mean, you would plant the rice, you'd wait for it to come up, to get to a certain size, but then there would be spraying.
Which, thought of it as a numbers game, who knows, it's a one in a million, might be resistant, but you knew the more that you sprayed, the more likely you were to find something.
And the amount of spraying that you were doing, was this similar to what you would find on a commercial farm? Did they spray that frequently?
They'd spray for other reasons, of course, but I'm just spraying once.
Well, farmers have a whole system, whether they go and add fertilizer later, so they might have a plane fly over a herbicide, or they might
put it on the tractor.
Fertilizer or herbicide or insecticide or whatever, so,
Yeah, the reason I'm asking the question is I'm just curious in terms of, yeah, if you're thinking of developing something that would be resistant compared to the red rice, are you looking for resistance in extreme herbicidal conditions, or would you be looking for what you might encounter? Like, are you looking for something that would survive a minimal amount of spraying that would kill the red rice but not affect those? And so I was wondering if that was a factor, if concentration levels were important.
Pretty much just set one concentration, the minimum it would take to kill the rice.
Okay. So. And during the growing season, when you were out spraying, was there much work going on in the lab at the same time?
Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah, because they would go out, so that's when they were doing a lot of anthiculture work, because they'd go out, the plants growing in the field, you have to get them at the exact right time to collect the anthers. So that was always going on, too. It was pretty year-round.
Okay. When you were spraying in the field and clearly things were dying from the sprays, you mentioned that there are other factors, right? Maybe there was a slight wind that day. Maybe something didn't get hit. Other things did get hit. If you had something that survived, how did you know if it survived because it was resisting the herbicide, or it survived because just randomly it wasn't actually hit with an herbicide?
You could look at the field later on and see how uniform the pattern of death was. Also, you just avoided situations where the wind was blowing at a significant.
But if you found a plant, then you would
dig it up,
put it in the greenhouse,
test it further indoors.
Or grow it up, collect the seed off of it,
right,
and then grow those plants.
Test the offspring.
And test the offspring.
So how often did you have, again, I know this probably changes over time, but in those early years, how many survived your herbiciding?
Oh,
not many.
Yeah.
I mean, every once in a while you get a false positive.
Yeah, false positive, but meaning it survived, but it was a puff of wind or something not prevented it from getting sprayed.
Okay. As you're doing this work, you have the two technicians to begin with. I know that there are others who came in to help with the planting, the herbicide work. Were you thinking of growing your lab in any other way in terms of personnel? Were there things that you weren't able to do because you were understaffed in those first few years?
Not so much. They funded us generously because it was an important goal we were pursuing. And, it would add to the success of the overall project, projects at the location.
The Rice Research Station was pretty famous internationally.
Right.
And there was always people that would want to come and do a postdoc or graduate work, especially out of China. Mm-hmm. And so in those early years, he went, and I'm trying to remember what year it was. It was pretty early in the 80s, right after China kind of opened up to be able to travel there. You went, and they were starting to do anthropoculture there, and that's when mm-hmm. you brought, I think it was Chu-Chi Ren over.
Chu Ren.
Yeah. And he came into your lab and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it started expanding pretty quick, personnel.
Didn't you get funding of like a penny for every 100-pound bag out of Louisiana or something
that,
like that?
That went to the station as a whole.
I see.
So it would depend on...
They called it checkoff funds.
Checkoff funds.
I see.
I would submit, you know, proposals and get funding for part of it, but not all of it.
From that.
Yeah.
I see.
And just when you say check off, C-H-E-C-K-O-F-F, because I was also thinking, since this is early 80s Russia, I didn't know if there was like Chekhov, like C-H-E-K-O-V. So I just wanted to confirm that it wasn't like a Russian name or...
They would, the rice farmers had agreed to, and I can't remember the exact number, but it was pennies per pound or whatever, right. Would put money into this fund. They called it the...
Chekhov.
Yeah, the rice Chekhov funds. And those monies would go to support the rice research station and the research, because the whole thing was then you bring all this information back to the farmers and they're benefiting from it. So they had agreed to do this.
Yeah, they'd put together a good system to research.
It was an additional source of funding that, and I think it was LSU administrators had kind of come up with this thing.
And rice was an important crop in the state, so.
I guess just to add to that, I mean, agricultural research has been supported by the government for hundreds of years, mm-hmm. right? Or 100 years, or
right.
yeah,
very consistently with these research centers and ag colleges. Right. And, right. you know, if you look and you say, well, it used to take, what, over half of humanity to grow our food, and now it takes 1%, or, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, that's the impact of that.
Right, USDA like, was big, and
yeah.
in fact, there was USDA personnel at the rice research station that was, you know, part of the whole, you know, thing with the rice.
So yeah, most crops you can, or maybe all crops, you can look at the productivity per acre, productivity per person, per year, that kind of thing, and plot it, and it looks a little bit like Moore's law for semiconductors, where it like keeps on improving, mm-hmm. keeps on improving, and it's like that, like corn and soybeans and everything, rice. Mm-hmm. It's pretty impressive.
Still going on.
It's not as steep a curve as semiconductors. It's not doubling every year
right.
and a half, but it doubles every 7 or 10 years or mm-hmm. 15 years or something, and you do that over and over again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a deal.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah. How many other researchers were at the Rice Research Station when you started there?
What do you think, 20?
We had, I think at one point, at least 16 faculty, and that was huge. That,
mm-hmm. yeah.
And they all had their programs, and everybody had, you know, their main technician plus all this help. So when you were talking about pictures in there, there's a great one that we took with Duke, and it's all the staff. It was kind of a like a year thing. We took this picture.
Duke was the head of the station.
Yeah. Everybody. And it was a good group of people. Everybody. And I think what was nice is the faculty, it was 100% research. So you'd go to campus every once in a while, have to give out a talk or whatever. You might be on a committee, but you didn't have that day-to-day teaching classes. And,
was there, you had mentioned earlier the, you know, getting some, the seed lines from the person who was doing research on disease. Was there a lot of collaboration, other collaboration that was going on at the research station? Mm-hmm. Were you collaborating with other faculty members there?
Well, my project was pretty separate from theirs. Everybody had their own projects. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't,
but I know some of like your somaclones. He was also working a little bit with wheat. You were given to Steve Harrison, and he was advancing some of those.
Yeah, he was a wheat
breeder.
Breeder.
So,
hmm.
There was, yeah.
eventually it would kind of move down the line to a breeder, right? You were, he was at the research stage and Sue was at the research stage. So once they had something that was looked really promising, it would kind of go into what maybe you'd call development in the pharmaceutical industry, but, you know, move toward commercialization. Mm-hmm. And there was staff that were professional at that,
right?
Formally breeding it.
Okay.
Rules, you know, how to do that.
And did the research station have any close connections to commercial farmers at that point, or was it more indirect? Okay.
There was a very close relationship.
And what was the relationship like? Were they involved? Were they funders? Were they?
Yes.
Okay.
There was Chekhov funds.
Okay.
So
the Chekhov
went to the station.
Okay. There was a yearly meeting where it was field day, and hundreds of people would come in that day. And everybody would be standing out in the hot sun, because it was usually June or July, at their research plots, and they would take them on trucks with hay bales, and, you know, hundreds of farmers would go and get this tour. You would stand there and give the same speech over and over to these different truckloads that would come through, and then they have a big meal, and the chancellor would be there and give a talk and stuff. So the farmers were definitely pro the rice station, and always, you know, what's new, what's coming out.
There's a close relationship with the farmers.
There was a category of personnel that were like farmer outreach, like
extension people,
yeah, right. Mm-hmm. That were always working with them, in touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And farmers were always coming by, you know, I got this going on, what do you guys think, or whatever, you know. So, and we were in a rural, I mean, there's literally a farmer right next to the rice station growing rice, you know, so there was, mm-hmm. it was in the heart of all of that.
Yeah, the rice region. Mm-hmm.
And with all the research that you're doing and the work that you're doing, is there also a publishing component to it?
Yeah.
Or are you taking the data and saying, like, look, none of these seeds worked? Or
we had the right annual reports, which were published.
They did not encourage you to do scientific publications.
Okay.
They said, don't worry about that. We got all this money. You don't need to write grants. You don't need to publish. You know, just do your work, do your work, do your work. And that went on until the oil industry changed. And all of a sudden, you guys need to be writing some grants and you need to be publishing. And because in order to get funding from a grant, you have to show some record and have to be publishing. So, you know, all of a sudden it's like, you know, breaks, you know, you got to kind of change what you're doing, because, you know, what he was doing, you know, soaking seeds in herbicides is not something that you would publish in a scientific journal.
Right.
Now, there was Popular Press things and Louisiana Ag, you know, articles and stuff like that, but not scientific, you know, crop science type papers going out.
But there were journals focused on...
Yeah, and there was some publication, but not a lot. There was annual meetings. The Rice Technical Working Group had meetings. There was, you know, other meetings. And your anticulture stuff, you did publish. In fact, you did, I think, a chapter in a book and that. Mm-hmm. So, but it wasn't like required. It was, you did it, but it wasn't...
there was a lot of pressure to do it.
Right.
So the individuals that were working at the research station, were they thinking of this kind of like a lifetime appointment, or hoping for it to be?
Mm-hmm.
I know you
pretty
can't.
Pretty much.
Okay. So it was, I'm going to settle here. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And so maybe that's why there wasn't too much of a concern for publishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Is in your scientific field, it seems like this might have been considered a dream job, but for other individuals that were working in this form of science, I'm thinking of growth in scientific communities, recognition, things like that. Were you aware of, even though you weren't publishing yourself, were you aware of what other people were doing? Were you still engaged with the journals? I think yesterday there was we talked a little bit about you would read an article And you'd present on it and you'd be like, all right, you know, this one, this person actually didn't do a good control or things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, were you still engaged with the literature
yes.
that others were publishing? And did you discuss that literature with others at the research station or in your lab or
with her?
That was one thing that, you know, since we both had the same kind of training and interest, even though
both
we were
faculty.
Working different crops, you know, we try to keep up on the literature and you know, see some article. Oh, what about this?
Yeah.
What about that?
And so if she saw something, she'd tell me. Mm-hmm. And same with me.
The approach that you decided to take in terms of looking for something that would survive this herbicide spraying, were you aware of any other researchers who had done similar things for different types of plants? Like, was this a process that was used previously maybe to make sure that soybeans or corn or something else could survive these herbicidal sprayings, or is this kind of a unique thing that you decided to
instantiate?
There were some other crops.
In
fact, when I was digging through your box, I came across some journal articles that you had pulled out and marked up. I think one was tobacco and one was, I can't remember what the other crop was, but you had been looking at what other people were doing.
Okay. And they were mutation and selection approaches?
Early on, Tim was not doing any kind of mutation work, more just screening of Somaclones, World Collection, or trying to cause. Another thing you were doing was putting herbicide in cell cultures, trying to, you know, so when you go to regenerate the plants, perhaps those would be herbicide resistant. You know, soaking the seeds and stuff like that. And then I can't remember exactly what year, but at one point then, and maybe we'd gone back to Davis and you talked to Rutger. He was a rice breeder at Davis.
Yeah.
He eventually went to Arkansas, I think. Had done
he was
some
geneticist.
That's right. You started doing X-ray radiation mutation was one of the first things you started trying.
So he recommended that you intentionally speed up the mutation rate.
He had done some work with it.
Right.
Yeah. And came up with a short stature rice.
Yeah.
And so then that's when Tim started working with radiation, and then which then went to the EMS chemical mutation.
Chemical. And what year was that?
In my notes that I didn't bring today.
rough time period. Was this still in the 80s? Was it pushing into the 90s?
No, it was late 80s. Probably.
Late 80s?
Yeah.
So in those first few years, you were just focused on this specific process, screening, developing, planting, seeing what worked.
Right.
And I think at that point, they were like, Tim, you've been doing this for 5 years. You don't have anything to show. Tim, you've been doing this for 6 years. You don't, you know, and it's like, but it's out there, you know, and he persisted and kept trying different approaches to coming up with this. And I think that was part of his
stubbornness.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was sort of moving towards in terms of your overall project, right? I think some individuals, after several years, like, okay, this hasn't worked. Like, how long am I going to keep on doing this? I'm wondering why you felt that this was going to be a productive way of finding this, right? Because it's not making this resistance, it's finding this resistance.
Right.
So do you recall why it is that you wanted to persist? Why you were convinced that this
was... No, but bottom line was I enjoyed doing it.
Okay.
I remember at one point at the end of the season, I didn't find anything, which was normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, get to do it next year too. And I went, what did I just say? You know, I was surprised I had that reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know you came out in 1984. You were, so I don't remember when you two got engaged. It was while you were still, it was before.
We got engaged in February of 84, married in July of 84, and I started August 1st in 84.
Okay. So whirlwind. Did you take
the PhD and everything. Yeah.
Did you take a honeymoon? Did you?
We did. Pebble Beach.
Okay, great. So like there was at least a little time off. Like,
right. Like
okay.
3 days.
So you come out to Louisiana in 84. You have a position at LSU as well, right? And you were focusing on soybeans.
And forage crops.
And forage crops.
Mainly forage crops initially.
Okay.
Forages was a big thing in Louisiana. You could pretty much grow grass year-round to feed cows. So it was almost every research station had two forage people and an animal scientist doing all over the state doing stuff.
Yeah, cattle was an important thing in the state.
So they had started Tim's program and they said, oh, we want to expand the biotech stuff. Let's bring in a forage person. And Tim says, oh, I know somebody.
Yeah.
So I don't immediately understand the relationship between forage and biotech. How, like, they wanted to expand biotech, so they wanted to bring in a forage person.
They wanted to expand the biotech presence in the field and bring in some other crops. And because forages were important to Louisiana, they said, let's bring somebody in working on, you know, in the field of biotech, but working on forage crops.
Okay. And so when you started LSU, was your experience similar to Tim's in terms of the size of the lab, right?
So to have a married couple in one department was a big thing.
Yeah, that was
and
a
they
big deal.
Really hemmed and hawed whether they were going to hire me and whether I was going to be located at the Rice Research Station versus on campus or somewhere else. And Duke sat us down and he said, if I agree to this, you know, you guys have to, you know, keep home at home and work at work, and neither one of you can advance in the ranks and be, you know, over the other one. Like, somebody couldn't become a department head. And we're like, that's fine. We don't want to be an administrator and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, can you, you know, share the facilities? And we're like, yep.
Sure.
We can do that.
Gladly.
And so where is your lab relative to...
So I use the same lab.
Same lab, okay. So, same general space.
Right.
Same facility.
Now they separate, you know, my office was over here and his office. In the office, there was an office building.
Yeah, we were opposite ends of the office building, but we shared lab.
Shared lab opposite ends of the office building. And so when you came in terms of the technologies, devices, the setup, for Tim's lab, did that mesh well with what you needed in terms of the work that you were going to do?
Right. The only thing was, you know, he was fully utilizing. So now all of a sudden, you know, here, you know, I'm coming in and I need just as much stuff. So they built some more greenhouses for us. They put in some more incubators. They kind of expanded the lab. And we might have even got another fume hood at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so they did...
Which is beneficial for both of us.
Right, right. And our groups were real good about, okay, I need all this space today, or I need all this space, and we'd work through it, or they would have a big push in the field to do something, and we'd go help them, or vice versa. So it really was a good working group.
Yeah, good teamwork.
And in terms of staff that you started with, did you bring in, or did they hire technicians for you? Or
yeah, I had two technicians and then a lot of student workers. Mm-hmm. And then over the years, had a, you know, visiting professor, had some graduate students and stuff.
And when you say student workers, undergraduates, graduate students?
Yes.
So the student workers were local kids from high school. They had to be at least 16.
Mm-hmm.
And every summer, it was a big thing to be a student worker at the Rice Station. And they would work all summer long. And when they would come in, it was like, okay, who did you get assigned to? Because the worst ones were the people that had to go out and work in the field every day and work the fields. And a lot of them, you know, wanted to come be in our labs because it was inside air conditioned. Yeah. I mean, you did have some field work, but a lot of it was inside and stuff. And then because our work was year-round, we were able to convince the administrators to expand that program so it wasn't just for the summer, but we could have student workers year-round. So these would be mm-hmm. high school kids or kids going to college, you know, locally, and they would come and work, you know, half-time kind of thing in the lab. And so that was a big, because a lot of what we were doing was just routine, you know, transferring cells and that kind of thing.
So were these student workers?
They had no knowledge of science.
Right.
That was a question that I was about to ask. So they had
no knowledge
of science.
Yeah.
Were you educating them in the science at the same time?
Yeah.
What were you trying to convey to them about the work, like the fundamentals of the work, the broad aspects of it?
Yeah, and I think it was interesting because some of them, they could have been flipping hamburgers. That it didn't matter. They, you know, you would teach them a skill, and they could just sit there and do it all day long.
Right.
But some of them had to be very specific because you said, you know, sometimes it was the look of the callus. Okay, if it looks like this, put it on this media. But if it looks like this, put it
on
here.
Yeah, if it's got little green dots.
You know, and it's like, well, how many green dots? Mm-hmm. You know, well, is it two, three? You know, and it's like, so you had to, some of them were real good at getting a feel for what to do. Others, you had to be very specific, and they did exactly what you said, you know, but they didn't really understand it. And then some of them would get inspired and like, oh man, this is like so cool. And they would want to then go on into college and study some things. So every once in a while, you'd get that one that would spark.
Get fired up.
And stuff. And then one of the things, a lot of the local schools, there was one, Carla Lambusa, she would always every year bring her, was it first graders? And every year they would come and tour the lab. And that was a big thing. We'd set up all this stuff and show them. And mm-hmm. They were just fascinated by the science. And
yeah.
You would get some dry ice and
yeah.
show them things. And we'd put things on a stir plate. And, you know, the kids were just, mm-hmm. here's science and stuff. But she was real excellent teacher, and so she
inspired. She's special.
Yeah. And how did you find the transition to Louisiana life?
it was a culture shock, mm-hmm. for sure. After growing up in California and then going in to a local grocery store, and it's, you know, here's some iceberg lettuce, and that's about it in the produce department. Mm-hmm. You know, it since has changed, but in the early 80s, people were still speaking French and in our community, and mm-hmm. it was hard to understand people and stuff. So there was definitely a transition, and people didn't know, there were not a lot of professional women. You know, there were some women doctors, but you know, nobody knew what a PhD was. And
yeah.
You'd meet somebody and they'd say, oh, where'd you go to school? And I'd say, UC Davis. And they'd look at me funny and they'd say, no, what high school did you go to? You
yeah.
know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, in San Diego. And they're like, oh, you're not from around here. Kind of thing.
Yeah. That was the standard saying, you're not from around here.
More broadly, what was the faculty makeup there in terms of gender? Were you the only? Mm-hmm. You were the only?
Oh, no. There was a geneticist that came in, but she was not well liked, Elaine Nowick.
Yeah.
And she clashed with the other, she was a Rice geneticist, and mm-hmm. she clashed with a lot of the other Rice people, and so she didn't.
She wasn't a very cooperative person.
No, she didn't last very long. So now on campus, there were some women, not many in the ag, but so a lot of times I'd go to campus and there'd be people there that I could interact with. But mm-hmm. In the forages, a lot of meetings I'd go to, I'd be the only woman.
Mm-hmm. What about at the technician level? Was it predominantly men? Was it mm-hmm. women?
No, our in the lab, it was mostly women.
Oh, in our lab, it was mostly women.
Right, but mm-hmm. then we'd have guys to do a lot of the field stuff.
But the rest of
the place,
it was men.
All men, yeah.
So did you encounter any difficulties?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that was, you know, part of being a woman in agriculture. You just kind of went along with it. But I'd always been kind of one of the guys hanging out, you know, kind of. I wasn't a real girl.
Right, yeah, I mean, you were buddies for 7 years.
Yeah,
right.
Right. Yeah. So right. I guess I was just kind of used to it. I grew up with two brothers, so.
Mm-hmm. And so when you came to LSU, you're now both in the same physical lab. Mm-hmm. You have your research focus. You have your research focus.
Right.
Was there any initial or any initial actual or plans to do some sort of collaboration since you were sharing the same physical space?
Not really collaborating.
We never had a formal collaboration.
We just would always help each other.
Yeah.
I mean, a classic thing was, you know, you'd be doing some calculation and can you double check me? And because he would go through a math process different than my math process. And if we came up with the same number, then we knew we were doing it right. The only thing we did collaborative, well, we did little projects collaborative that we have our names on. There was something with protoplasts and stuff. But there was a big grant. We wanted to expand the facility. Okay, so this was like when now genetic engineering is happening. People are like getting genes and mm-hmm. stuff. And we're thinking, oh, maybe this is our next step.
Yeah, maybe we ought to be doing that.
So we wrote a grant. And we got a big chunk of money to physically add on to the lab. They busted through one of the walls and attached another lab. And we outfitted with all this just high tech, you know, whatever the latest was back then.
Microbiology equipment, yeah.
Right. And as this process is happening, that's when all the stuff about consumer acceptance started popping up. Mm-hmm. And by the time the facility was done, and ready for us to use, we're starting to kind of putting the skids on it.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't want to be doing that.
Don't wanna.
I mean, back then, initially, they would do things like they'd attach an antibiotic to a gene because that's the only way they could trace it. And, you know, antibiotics in your plants, you don't want that.
Yeah, antibiotic resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And stuff. So,
GMO plants were starting to get a lot of attention by industry, but some resistance by consumers.
Wow.
Exactly.
Right.
So roughly what time frame are you talking about here?
Ooh, the late 80s, early 90s maybe.
Because I think you'd mentioned that it was the late 80s
mm-hmm.
probably where you were seeing, like, because you had to apply for grants, this
yes.
is when you needed to start publishing to
right.
demonstrate things. So I was wondering if it coincided with...
Yes, kind of all of that was happening, right.
Right. So late 80s, early 90s is
right.
when... you're applying for grants, you're starting to publish because you need the recognition, and you look to expand to think about genetically modifying things, and then people don't want
right.
genetically modified things. Or at least
right.
people, I should say people in the U.S., some people in the U.S.
Right.
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 A lot of people in Europe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of people
yeah,
in Europe.
People
right.
Sure.
Right.
Right.
How did you become aware of this reaction towards genetically modified organisms?
The tomatoes.
What's that?
Do you remember the tomato story?
Go ahead.
Oh, so they, what was the place in Davis? They came up with this modified tomato.
Flavor Saver tomato?
Yeah.
Flavor Saver.
You know, because it was, you know, they put all this work into it because I can't remember the specifics, but it was meatier or whatever, make better tomato sauce or whatever. And then all of a sudden, you know, they did all this work. The company bought it and then just buried it because consumer acceptance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was something to do with, so they had genetically engineered corn for Roundup resistance, I believe. And some of that corn got into taco shells.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming up with GMO contaminated taco shells, and it was, you know, big recall on taco shells one year, I remember.
Yeah, big red light.
And so
on.
Yeah, and so it was like, okay, wait, we don't want to do this kind of thing. Now we could use the lab for other things,
right?
But it was like, we're not gonna start plunking genes into stuff, and that's when your stuff really started expanding with the radiation and the chemical EMS approach.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were thinking of moving in this direction in terms of genetically modifying things, did you have, because you'd mentioned there was some of that stuff starting when you were in graduate school. Did you actually have experience with the techniques that you would need to use in order to do this genetic modification?
Not really.
No.
No.
So you know, the plan was maybe to hire individuals to handle that type
like,
of work?
Like a postdoc.
Yeah, postdoc.
Or,
postdoc.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. You also mentioned that this is roughly the same period of time where you started to expand the type of research or do different things to try to create a resistant version of rice. What were the things that you were looking to do to modify the organism without genetically modifying the organism?
So that was the chemical mutation.
Yeah, the chemical mutation, sodium and EMS, which is causes mutations.
What does EMS stand for again?
Ethylmethane sulfonate.
Okay.
So you're looking to force mutations that are random, or were you trying to control the types of mutations?
They were random.
Random.
There's okay. No way to control it, really.
Okay.
Just speeding up the rate.
Just speeding up the rate of the actual
mutations. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And why is it that you wanted to try that approach? I mean, you had been doing things one way for, I'm going to say 7 years. I'm randomly choosing a number. You'd been doing things for one way, in one way for 7 years. Why did you want to switch up your methodology for?
I guess to just explore the potential of new approaches.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Did you have any concerns that this increased rate of mutation could be seen as similar to genetic modification? I know you're not inserting genes from, like you're not taking a fly gene and putting it into rice, but you're forcing the rice to change more rapidly than it naturally would.
There was a pretty clean distinction between the EMS type work and...
Foreign insertion, just what you said, insertion of something
foreign
versus
there's nothing
modifying
being inserted.
You weren't moving any antibiotic resistance
material.
Or anything.
I was just curious. So I'm asking the question because I'm wondering if, like the general population who were rejecting GMOs, would they have thought similarly? Like, would they have said, well, that's GMO, that's not GMO? Or was it more about like you're trying to rapidly change something in ways that nature didn't intend?
Yeah.
So I was just curious if it was like...
It turned out... That there wasn't that concern.
Okay.
I think once you explained it to people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I thought I might have sent you that article. There's an article in Louisiana Ag where, and this is after you found your rice, that Tim actually explains that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That concept.
Yeah.
I'll send that to you.
Yeah. No. I've read that. Just.
Oh. Okay.
Some of the questions I ask, I know the answers to.
Okay.
But I'd like to get them on the recording. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to hear if there are further explanations or rationales or
I think
things like
consider
that.
It, you know, an accelerated natural process,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, nothing was happening that wouldn't happen naturally. It's just the pace was faster.
Right.
Right.
Though you did also mention using radiation as well.
You tried that a few
years. Tried it, but we didn't really get too involved in that.
I think that's how... Neil had come up with his short stature was radiation.
Right.
And so that's why you
started
with
it. So there was precedence for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you experimented with it for a little while, but then didn't continue?
Yeah.
Is there a reason you decided not to continue with that method?
There wasn't any
particular reason. You read about EMS, and I think you just decided that was
just started using EMS.
Okay.
So to do the radiation, he had to go to campus, and he can only take so many pounds of seed at a time.
Mm-hmm.
With the EMS, he could ramp that up.
I have
into
more control over the quantities and stuff.
Okay, because your facility wasn't built to handle the radiation.
Right, we didn't have a whatever.
We didn't have that facility.
The machine to do that. Yeah.
Okay. So this is the late 1980s. You're shifting your methodology somewhat to hopefully affect. A more rapid change in the genetic sequence naturally,
mm-hmm.
right? Not using modification. Were you able to expand? Let me phrase this question differently. As time progressed, as you were working, did the plots of land that you have had access to in order to plant these seeds, did those increase, or were you still limited to the, I think you said it was 20 acres? I'm trying to remember the number from earlier.
20 acres is a lot, though.
Yeah. But like, if you wanted to, I didn't know if you had access to more space to try different mutations. And
I could go in and request more land, and they were cooperative with it. Mm-hmm. We were pretty much blowing and going, so they would put some more than what we requested.
Okay. And when you were using these mutated varieties, did you see any that had promise for herbicide resistance?
Yeah.
In those early years?
Well, some of them would appear to have been herbicide resistant, but weren't. Mm-hmm. When you retested them, you found out they weren't, genetically anyway.
Okay.
And that's so what we call a false positive.
Yeah, that's where he'd go dig up the plant, bring it into the greenhouse, grow it up, collect the seed, test that next generation.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out it was just normal rice.
Part of the reason I was asking that is I'm curious to know whether or not you were thinking of trying to, if let's say you had some things that seemed to be working, or maybe they were false positives, but maybe they were like, well, they lasted a little longer than some of the other ones that died immediately. I was curious to know whether or not you had any intention of, or if you tried to see what mutations you actually caused in order to see if there's a way to maybe breed for that specifically.
Yeah, we weren't really set up for pursuing that kind of work.
Okay. So it was just going to be, if it was it was a random mutation, if it survived, you tried to have it reproduce, right?
Exactly.
And so that's how you'd be
test the offspring.
Test the offspring. Would you ever then try mutating that offspring to see if a further mutation?
Well, you generally didn't want to get in any additional mutations because they're usually deleterious.
Okay.
So if you got the mutation you wanted to just grab that and run.
Mm-hmm. While you were working on this project, were there any other projects that you wanted to, or that you were undertaking while at the facility?
High protein.
And the marsh.
The marsh projects.
Right.
Yeah, there were some plants they could potentially use to control coastal erosion.
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved with guy who wanted to get involved in that business wise.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all legit. It wasn't behind the screens or anything like that. So did a little work on that.
So was this someone also at the research station? Or was this?
No, that was just a businessman in New Orleans. He actually found me because there was an article in the newspaper about the work, and he got hold of the newspaper, and I all of a sudden I get this phone call, and this guy wants to talk to me because he wants to work on doing protecting erosion areas that were eroding along the coastline. And he thought using some of these coastal plants would be. He had a nursery, and he wanted to get into coastal plants for his nursery operation.
So, what was it that was in the newspaper that piqued his interest?
What was that? There was an article, I guess, about just using plants for coastal erosion control.
Yeah, but I think you were doing something at the time, and I don't
remember
specifically what it was that tweaked his interest. But
yeah, it did.
I think just
you're right.
Biotech, and I think part of it was. The practice was to go to some area of the marsh, dig up plants, and then take them to another part of the marsh and plant them. Mm-hmm. You know, and very labor intensive, and it was had to do with encapsulating the seed. If you could.
Oh, that's artificial seed.
Right.
Right.
So I think maybe he saw the thing about regenerating the plants.
Right.
And I think that's maybe what tweaked him in terms of if you could take. Say, Spartina, and have all these little plants that you're developing in the lab, regenerating or whatever, and then you encapsulate them in a gel, and then and then you fly them out on the marsh, and then they grow, kind of thing. So that way of seeding the marsh.
Right.
So was that something that you had been interested before this businessman approached you? Like, were you playing around in the in the marshes?
I was, but that's
not really
not to a very.
He likes to fish. So, and crab, right? You eat crab.
Yeah, not crab, but fish. Yeah.
But yeah, fish. Yeah, sometimes catch crabs.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, but you were, you yourself weren't focused on or weren't concerned about erosion issues. Or
I was after I met this guy.
After you met the guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so after you met and he proposed or he presented his idea to you, what was it about that that made you want to pursue a relationship, a working relationship with the individual?
Because it was a real problem for Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Coastal erosion was serious.
And so how is he and how were you proposing to fund this this work? Was it going to be something that happened through like a grant through the...
Well, he had greenhouses, so he was willing to, and employees, mm-hmm. not very many, a handful, but he had employees, so...
But he also had connections.
Yeah, he was also kind of politically connected.
Okay. But this was still going to be like privately funded work, this...
Right.
No.
Well, no.
You went to D.C.
No, I went to D.C.
with him.
And, yeah.
So... He had been a, I don't know what his exact title was, but maybe like a chief of staff or something, but not really chief of staff, for a senator from Louisiana. So he knew people in D.C. pretty intensely. So
yeah.
You and went up to the, who was in charge of appropriations for the House? I want to say somebody like, I can't remember his last name, Johnson or something like that. Anyway, he was from Louisiana.
Okay.
And... went and
just thought about this in a long time.
Yeah, and it was so. Tim actually took vacation time and we paid for it ourselves for him to go up to D.C. because it didn't want it to be convoluted and stuff, and had this conversation and they agreed. Yeah, we need to appropriate, and it was several million dollars.
Yeah,
and then when Tim came back. LSU and said, look, you know, we found this source of money. LSU went, whoa, wait, whoa, stop. That's not how we do things, you know. It's like, and, but it all worked out. The money came, and that's when they really started working on that mm-hmm. approach to.
That was a pretty separate project.
Yeah.
But the money ultimately came through LSU?
Right. I mean, the federal government provided funding. So it was
a grant.
Right.
To the institution, and you were the principal investigator for that grant?
Exactly, yeah.
Did that mean, did that grant allow you to, were you setting up a new research space in order to do this work?
No, just doing it in the same facility and using some of the same techniques.
And what about staff? Were you increasing the staff to work on that?
I want to say we did bring in somebody.
Maybe one or two people. It wasn't a great expansion of any sort.
And so can you explain to me what the overall problem was? I understand the term coastal erosion. What was causing it? What were your initial ideas about how to address that?
Well, it was a plant that could hold the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the bottom line.
So it just
needed a way to propagate it. I think the thought at the time was using tissue culture to propagate the plant.
Yeah, because it didn't produce a lot of viable seed.
Yeah.
So if you could, again, regenerate plants in the lab and then encapsulate them. And you guys had played around with that and actually made some of that. I want to say you took them to D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And so these little regenerated plants, encapsulate them, and then, you know, this process worked. But then you also looked for naturally occurring plants that held on to more viable seed
mm-hmm.
and tried to then propagate those and
yeah.
use those as a source.
Find natural
right.
sources.
Right.
How would you go about finding these?
Go out on a boat.
Okay. So kind of like going out in the field and planting, you were out in a boat and you were just like digging in the marshes?
Yes, exactly.
Pulling out plants. And how would you go about testing them?
Bring them back to the facility and test
just,
them.
Just test them, try to grow them, see what they would produce.
Try to collect seed off of them and see if you plant those and get them to sprout.
Why wasn't it, so if soil erosion was a concern and having more plants be planted would solve the problem, why weren't people just, you know, why wasn't the state investing in having people go out into fields and just plant more plants?
I don't know. They just didn't have the foresight, I guess.
The cost.
What do you say? And I guess the cost, yeah.
So, they probably didn't have the plants available. But so who would have provided the... This, partly if these guys could figure out how to do this.
But,
they would have all these plants.
But if you calculate, if you do the calculations on how many people to physically go plant an acre, you could fly it on with a plane acres.
Right.
Yeah,
you can do acres in minutes with an airplane.
And so the hope was you would just find, you'd find a plant that was extremely productive in terms of producing seeds, so that way it would be a, and so you find that plant, you find the seeds, and then you reproduce, or you have the plant reproduce, so that way you have a lot of seeds to just like toss on an area.
Right. Right.
Sort of like crop dusting, but with...
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
And with, you would also sort of crop dust with the encapsulated plants. Right?
Yeah.
Wasn't the idea.
That was the other thing.
Not just seeds, but the whole plants would come down and maybe somehow...
Some would take?
Some would take.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
A numbers game.
Yeah.
Essentially. Like,
yeah.
If you throw in 1,000 and 100 take...
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Then you got 100 plants now.
Mm-hmm. And so the research, how long did it take you... overall to find a plant that would work, a plant that you could develop more? Was this a relatively fast turnaround? Was it
question?
So I think they found something pretty quick. The process was kind of evolved. But at the same time, your herbicide stuff was ramping up. And LSU had this federal money coming in, and they put other faculty pulled a lot of it away from Tim and gave it to other researchers. And so LSU started expanding what they were doing on coastal erosion through this process, because they hadn't been doing a lot. And so Steve Harrison and some other people kind of took that project over. And you were involved with a little
They were located on campus.
But
so.
They kind of... pretty much took that over, and but at that time you were finding your first plants and things were expanding on that.
And what's the general time frame for this? Is this the early 90s?
Yeah.
Early 90s. All right, and so can you tell me a little bit more, since you mentioned that things were kind of ramping up, what was going on in your red rice herbicide research at the time that you could classify it as it was ramping up? Like, were mutations working?
I mean, you were going through hundreds of pounds of seed and putting them out and spraying and stuff, and then you were starting to find that plant, and, and it's like that day, because he would go out early in the morning again before it got too hot and walk the fields and look for that plant. And I remember I was home, hadn't even got to work yet, and you came back and it's like, there's a plant, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, shh, you know, I don't want anybody to go over there and step on it or dig it up or whatever, you know, kind of thing.
And that's the photo. You have the photo of that plant, right?
Yeah.
What year was that?
I want to say it was 94. It was, you know, 92, 93, 94, because our kids were babies, and it was all this was happening, and and 94 was when I think you came up with the first one, and then you ramped it up and came up with the second one that was better, because it was in 98 that the license agreement was signed, so it was in that time frame. And on these field days, Tim would talk about this, and more chemical companies would, you know, they would come to these field days too, and they were getting interested in it, and that's when it was American Cyanamid at the time. They would have some, what's the right word, new herbicides coming out that weren't being used yet. What's the right word I'm thinking? Experimental types of things. Yeah. And they were, you know, suggesting to him, you know, let's try this herbicide or this herbicide, you know, because they all had different modes of action. And you pretty much settled on one in particular, and its mode of action was similar to all these other types of herbicides that American Cyanamid produced.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to take a quick
body
break.
So your research was ramping up at this point in time. I also wanted to ask a little bit about, I know you have three children. Mm-hmm. I was guessing their rough ages when I was coming up with the my interview protocol. I was assuming late 1980s, early 1990s is when you start a family. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know how you managed having a family with your scientific work. I know for me, I have three children. Mm-hmm. I still don't sleep that much. but it's a challenge, right?
Yes.
Like, and so I'm wondering how becoming a parent, if it changed the way that you were doing work in any way in those early years. And then, you know, as the kids get older, I'm also curious to know, and we can talk about it later, whether or not you incorporated them into the research that you were doing. I don't know if they were out in the field spraying the herbicide.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's the 90s,
yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, right.
who needs hazmat suits,
yeah,
even,
right.
even then? So I'm just curious, you know, to start with, you know, what was it like starting a family and managing that with the work, the scientific work that you were doing?
Yeah, how do you answer that?
So, excuse me. So it was difficult having children. And so we did infertility. And so there was a place in New Orleans. So I would get up, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, drive to New Orleans, do whatever testing, and get back, you know, so that I could be at work at 8 kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. So it just... just kind of fitted in. The Rice Station was very 8-to-5 attitude. They wanted you physically there. It was different than on a campus, you know, where as long as you got your work done, it didn't matter what
right.
hours you were there. So we tried to kind of work around that schedule. And then we were fortunate that we were able to have kids. Pete in 89 and Carolyn in 91. And we lived on the research station. They provided housing for faculty there.
Oh.
That was kind of part of your compensation for the
mm-hmm.
low salaries. it was about a 1,200 square foot house and had one little bathroom, but it had 3 bedrooms. And,
mm-hmm.
And it, you had a 1-minute commute to work because it was, you know, you were literally
on
the property, so
mm-hmm.
you were right there all the time. And so we just, and one thing about being in a little town like that is you can find somebody local to kind of come to your house and take care of the kids. So we were fortunate that we found somebody that, you know, she would come in the morning and we could go off to work and then come back. And
mm-hmm. What was her name again?
Karen.
Karen, yeah.
Miss Karen.
Yes.
And there was Bill came along in 93.
And 93, yes.
And what was the LSU's policy on maternity and paternity leave?
There wasn't any. So I had saved up as much vacation time as I could
mm-hmm.
so that when I had Pete, I took, I think, 2 months off or something like that. But then Carolyn came along pretty quick, so I didn't have as much time, but I think I probably took a month off. But by that time Bill came along, I had no vacation time. So I literally went back to work after a week.
Wow.
But I was able to zip home and feed them and then
yeah.
go back to work and stuff like
yeah.
that because we
home
were physically...
Was 5 minutes from work.
Yeah, since we were physically there. But,
and Tim, did you modify your schedule at all after the kids were born?
I don't recall during that.
No.
Not a broken male tradition.
No, another tradition.
Yeah. Given the research that you were working on, I don't know what other research was happening, all the other research that was happening at the research station. Did you have any concerns about raising a family in close proximity to where, you know, lots of chemicals are being sprayed or mm-hmm. Genetic mutations are now taking place? I know the radiation facility was on campus, so okay. Maybe it wasn't like real close, but did you have any concerns about raising a family physically in such close proximity to?
My big thing was that we didn't drink, we had well water mm-hmm. from the station. So I would buy purified water because I didn't want the kids drinking the well water. That was probably about the only really
thing.
Yeah,
it's the only precaution we really did.
Yeah, we'd open the door and let the kids run and play in the mud outside. Mm-hmm. And it was.
You would use protective gear when you use the EMS, wouldn't you?
Oh, definitely.
Was that being a hood?
And a mask, yeah.
A mask and probably a
gloves.
Because that would be a no.
Oh, yeah. Gloves.
Mutagen, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And you always did that. You didn't let anybody else handle it because there was a whole process on dealing with the EMS.
Didn't want any of the workers to get exposed.
Okay.
And it was not, I mean, it's still controversial over whether, you know, herbicides actually have a real issue. But, you know, there's thousands of studies shows that Roundup safe and then a few that says it isn't. And then
right.
Well, $10 billion later, right, these lawsuits. But,
this
there's a lot of stuff saying it's safe, right?
But the herbicide that Tim was working with was safe because the enzyme that it works on, people, animals, insects don't have, only plants have.
Right.
And that was one advantage of that particular herbicide is it could be used in very low quantities, plus the enzyme was not in human systems.
So there's nothing for it to interact with.
Right.
In
exactly.
Humans.
Right. Ideally.
Right.
Ideally.
That we know of.
Just as a quick question, and then I'd like to return to the research aspects. As the kids got older, yesterday you had mentioned that at least for the youngest siblings in the family, you know, mom brought them to the lab, right, to help out and to do things like that. Did your kids ever come to work with you? And if so, what were they?
They would come, especially like if something after hours or checking on the weekends and stuff. Yeah, so they kind of were exposed to plants. Mm-hmm. And I was also working with an entomologist at the time. And she was a character. She didn't have any kids, but she loved our kids. And she's would bring them, you know, like these, I don't remember the names for all, you know, these giant grasshoppers or giant beetles. And, oh, here, you need a pet. And she'd bring it to the aquarium and stuff. And then we were doing stuff with fall armyworms and in the lab, and I was having to produce the armyworms in the lab, grow them up and stuff, so you had the moths lay the eggs and all that. There was a whole process. And I remember one time the kids had to do a science project, and I'm like, ooh, why don't you take these armyworms and you could do this, this, and this? And it was like, it was a little bit too much for them at the age that they were, but they ended up doing something. But yeah, they were definitely exposed to the lab and you know, seeing all the things and science. And
did they ever become some of those summer students? Or I know it became the year round at some point, but like, no, they were never
they
summer didn't. Students in the lab or anyone else's lab?
No.
Okay. In terms of the research that you started to have success with, were you using, so was this work that was just pure mutation, or was it you had been soaking some of the seeds in herbicide to see if those would become resistant? What type of seed were you having success with, the mutated or the herbicide soaked or?
The mutated.
Mutated, yes.
It was the mutated version.
Yes.
All right. And so you described the you know, going out one morning and finding this viable plant in a field. What made this one stand out more to you? Just that it existed, or that was there something about where it existed in the field that made it seem like this is interesting?
What you look for is that there's death and destruction completely surrounding it,
mm-hmm.
because there's constantly plants that a puff of wind had happened just as the equipment spraying that spot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got very good at looking at it and seeing that it was totally uniform. The response was totally uniform around it, so it wasn't an escape.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually sprayed.
So this was probably something more in the middle than on the margins of the area planted?
Not necessarily.
No?
Usually in the middle of, because that's where most of the plants are.
Okay. All right. And so once you discovered that plant, what were the next steps that you took?
Go back to the lab, get some containers. I'd get them out of the field pretty quickly because didn't want some unfortunate event to, you know, mess things up. So I'd take them back and get them in the greenhouse,
mm-hmm.
to protect them.
And so once in the greenhouse, what was the process then? You just let it continue to grow?
Grow it up. So the main interest was to make sure that the progeny was resistant.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do is get seeds off of it and test the seeds for the next generation.
And one thing nice about a rice plant is it'll send up a shoot, a seed head. You can collect that seed, but you can then cut the rice back and you can
it'll
get
regrow.
Mm-hmm.
So you can collect off this one plant a lot of seed that then he could go back to test.
In the greenhouse, did you expose it to herbicide there as well? Did you keep trying to kill it?
I don't think so, because it's you hated to kill something that was actually did have some resistance.
Okay.
And you sprayed it twice, and
mm-hmm.
it was one time too many. You know?
Okay. So you collected the seeds from this plant,
mm-hmm.
right? And then did those seeds go back into the field?
Did all that testing, I think, in the greenhouse.
The individual seeds would be planted.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he could take all of those and then in the greenhouse grow those up. And then you would pull them outside because you didn't want to spray in the greenhouse. And then spray. And so then if they all, or whichever ones were good, you would grow them up. So now you, over the winter time, you would grow those plants and collect as much seed. So come growing season the next year, now you had a lot of seed off this original plant that you could then put out in the field and start doing more advanced testing.
By far the majority of what you found was good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you retested it, it turned out to be resistant.
By that time?
Yeah.
Versus earlier, a lot of false positives.
Right.
So you had this one plant that seemed very, potentially very good, or
mm-hmm.
potentially good.
Right.
You grow it a bit more in the greenhouse, you get more seeds. Next
mm-hmm.
growing season, you spread the seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Were they isolated to one specific field, these specific seeds, or did you distribute them among different?
Yeah, it'd be in one field.
In one field,
right.
Okay. So you plant them in one field, you do your normal spraying process,
mm-hmm.
and what happens?
You look for damage on the controls. You put in a control that's just normal rice,
mm-hmm.
and you compare what the response was after spraying.
Okay. And what was this response like with this new?
Wonderful. It didn't look like it had been sprayed.
Didn't look like it. So there were still the control ones that did die.
Yeah,
right?
dead as could be.
And so was this... Did you have a cluster that survived? I'm just trying to picture the field.
Yeah, they're individual rows. So you,
oh, okay.
The way you planted them so that each plant would get a full dose.
Okay.
From the spray, as opposed to, you know, a big clump or something like that where they might protect each other.
Mm-hmm. And so you have the success with this new planting.
Right.
What steps did you take after that? Did you have to go through another cycle?
See, I think I'd dig them up in the field because you didn't want something bad to happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Could be anything that might get killed in the field in some way. And bring them in the greenhouse.
Okay.
So they were protected from the weather and stuff.
So you brought this new batch into the greenhouse.
Right.
You went through the process of growing them, harvesting
right.
the seeds.
Right.
Did you So did you wait for another planting cycle and growing cycle before?
Yeah.
Okay.
Progeny tested the root test.
Okay. So you did another cycle and same results?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
They all survived.
Yeah.
The controls died.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so this is now, roughly, is this 1993 that you had that the progeny had the success?
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
That sounds right.
94, 95, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe a little later.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the patent was filed on November 28th, 1994. So.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So you would have had this plant and you would have been working with the attorney to do that patent, get that patent in. Because there's a time lag between, you know, when you submit a patent and it gets approved and stuff. So if it was approved in 94, you were, yeah.
But it was filed in 94, approved in, issued in 96.
Okay.
So you probably got the original plant in 93.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then would you grow it in the greenhouse over the winter?
Yes.
Yes.
And then the next cycle was that spring or
summer. That spring, summer, you had success, confirmed.
Progeny good, now you file the patent.
And now you file the patent.
Right.
Okay.
But at the same time, he's also doing more EMS and more, and looking, and then you found a second one.
Right.
So another just a random mutation that wound up being, and so there wasn't anything that you were doing in the EMS work. It was, again, just purely random. Okay.
And I think, if I remember correctly, they were slightly different on their whether mutation occurred. So when they did the DNA analysis, right, if I remember correctly, one had a modification at one place and one was at the other place.
I think so.
And,
one wasn't derived from the other, they're independent mutations.
Right. So we had, and they had names and numbers, but, and then he had these two particular lines, and you did studies looking at, on a range of herbicides,
different rates,
how these two compared, and then you also did a cross between the two and compared that to see how they would do.
And it was a single mutation that provided the resistance in each case versus, I believe, could have this wrong, but Roundup resistance requires two.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole technique, if he had gone after Roundup, probably would not have worked because he couldn't have simultaneously.
Right.
Got too many.
It would have been like, you know, one in a million times one in a million,
right.
One in a billion times one in a billion.
Right.
It's like, no, wasn't going to work.
Infinitesimal chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So once you determined that this was a viable plant, I know that you filed for the patent. Was that, let me start, I had too many so's in that sentence. Once you realized that this was viable, what were the steps that you took to inform the research station about your results? Like, I'm wondering how things unfolded that relatively soon after that you are filing a patent. Was this standard practice at LSU? Like, you report on a research result and it automatically goes to the patent office. And I'm also curious to know how people responded to the fact that you had this file.
Oh, that's a good question. Do you remember?
So filing patents was not maybe in engineering or something like that, but not in plant sciences.
Yeah.
That was pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. People would, PVPs? Plant variety
protection,
you know, when you would release a new variety or something like that. But this was a different type of patent. It wasn't on a particular, it was on the
utility patent.
It was a utility patent, right. And so that was kind of something different. And, but he had a good attorney that was pretty sharp on, I guess he had a chemistry background.
Right.
It was part of it. And so in terms of writing out this patent, it was, you know, you'd get it to proofread it, and it's like it's so much lawyer talk, but you realize all the little subtleties. It wasn't just you have a plant. It was spraying the plant and spraying weeds around the plant and all the little wordings that go into making that patent.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the industry was very interested when they found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that started the whole kind of snowball of now what happens after that, because this is pretty unique situation.
Yeah, and I'd say, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my memory of it, that, you know, Tim had some notion that money could be made here, but wasn't real familiar with that whole system because it wasn't part of the LSU ag station world.
Right.
And but I come out of engineering and, you know, MIT, and there's license deals all the time. Bob Langer is a friend of mine.
Right.
So he called me, you know, with sort of request of how does this work? You know, how do you do this stuff? What's the nature of the deals that go down? What are the terms? You know, and I have a lot of friends that are business development people and, you know, familiar with faculty that do this stuff all the time. So we talked on the phone and I called some of my friends and gave them, you know, feedback on your questions, really. And then I think you were then confident at that point. I mean, you had some notion you could do it, and then now you knew you could do it.
Right.
And then held his ground as, you know, to make sure it would happen. Like, you know, this is not just my crazy idea that we can file patents and license it and make money for the university and make money for me and my family. I mean, you know, other places, there's lots of discoveries by academics that aren't in engineering, you know, not used to licensing things,
right,
not used to patenting things, that they get nothing. You know, the university gives it away. Nobody figures out you could do some licensing deal. You know, just the corporation just makes more money.
Right.
They charge exactly the same.
Right, right.
Whatever the market will bear, right? It's just the university gets shorted and the inventor gets shorted.
And I think from the information that you, Matt, gave Tim, and then there was a Ken Koontz. He was kind of the development guy over at LSU.
Yeah.
And he was a very bright individual.
He's a bright guy.
And so Tim would go and talk to him, and they kind of came up with, yes, okay, this is how we can approach the company and stuff like that. But then you had to go convince the administration of, okay, you know, here's a way to make money for the university, and, you know, patent this and propose this license to the company. And
right.
then that started all the kind of negotiations. And
it was pretty impressive overall, because it wasn't like he was part of a system where this just was a machine cranking out. Like, you're a professor at MIT and, you know, you do a big discovery, they just line you up with meetings with all the top venture capitalists in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You negotiate the best deal if there's something you had from it. And, you know, he had to, like, get the whole university along and get the whole system going. You know, this is how it can all work.
Again, the Krogan persistence.
They're hesitant.
Yeah, hesitant. So,
and that's what I was going to ask about, because I wanted to be certain that, again, I'm familiar with MIT, and so, like, you have entire departments that are like, okay, can we patent this? And they're looking for those developments. And it sounded like it wasn't LSU or the Rice Research Station that was like, hey, this is a great thing, let's try to do something with it. You were the one coming up with the suggestion, like, this is a great thing.
Yeah.
We need to do something with it.
Yeah, that's true.
I think they knew it was a great thing, but they weren't used to...
They had no clue.
The licensing deals, or that the university could make money, and, you know, they were just, I think, typically going to just give it away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And was there anything in your agreements with the university about rights of ownership over materials created? Since, I mean, it was a grant-funded institution you were receiving money from.
Yeah.
So at that time, they had all a little policy book you could go through, and one of their policy things was an inventor gets 40%, and the university gets 60%. And that was the policy when this happened. And so that's what we were going into the negotiations with, that as part of the policy.
Yeah,
they have since changed that policy.
On the royalties after expenses, right?
Right, after
40-60.
Right.
Which is pretty generous.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's quite good.
So you file in 1994, you used, so it was an attorney that you sought out to write the...
He was a university's attorney.
Oh, he was the university's attorney, so he just happened to have a chemistry background, so it wasn't...
Right.
So you were fortunate in that way.
Right.
So the patent is filed in 94, right? It's issued in 1996. You also have the other variety that you that wound up being a bit better and I forget the dates for the for that patent specifically. But what winds up happening, does anything happen between when you file in 94 and when it is issued in 96? Or do things only really start happening with companies and companies' interests after it's actually issued?
That's a good question.
Well, so when you're going to release a variety, it can't have just herbicide resistant. It also has to yield well, it has to have good quality, yeah. It has to
right.
have, you know, it can't be
disease
too tall,
disease,
you know. So it has to go through a rigorous test. So you can't just take this plant and say, oh, it's great, let's run with it. So typically what's done is you want to move that trait into a variety. And I think one of yours went directly as a variety.
Mm-hmm.
But then Tim had the foresight of saying, we need to get this gene in all these Louisiana varieties, but all these other varieties in all these other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So he contacted breeders all over the world and said, send me your emerging best lines, and I will move this trait into your lines. And then you will end up, and there's a whole process with back crossing, and you know, first you make the first cross, and then you do a lot of back crossing to get now basically the original variety that you started with, but now it has this trait that's been moved
trait. Into. Yeah, that trait.
And it wasn't like just call up and yeah, send me some seed. Of course, there's a lot of paperwork involved because now you have something that's being patented. You have to have all these licenses and agreements and blah 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 blah. So things really kind of ramped up around, and then when you're dealing with international things, you have to have all kinds of clearance for quarantine, moving, you know, rice seeds back and forth and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tim really then focused on getting that gene into a lot of varieties, and I think that was the key to getting it out there. Because if you look like the typical sequence of a new variety and when it's released, there's such a, it could be years, and a patent only lasts 20 years, so you need to get something out there right away in order to capture the benefit of that.
And so just to clarify, so since this was unique in terms of patenting, and it's a utility patent, patenting this specific version of rice, the typically varieties, like these new varieties, are they patented as well? Like when you have a new variety coming out or a more productive version, those typically patented?
So then you have a plant protection, a plant patent.
Yeah.
It's a different type of patent.
Okay.
So his genes patented, but then these individual plant lines can also be patented. And so when their little clock starts ticking, that extends the time out. Yeah, kind of.
Correct me if I'm wrong, well, I mean, would for sure credit the patent attorney for the university, did a great job. He's really, he or she?
He.
Yeah.
I mean, really great patent attorney, and I, you know, work a lot of expert witness cases, and so any weakness in claims, you know, can cost you a case.
Yeah.
Right. And he did a really good job writing the claims.
Yeah.
And and I think my memory of a utility patent or the patent is that has more to do with spraying.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like if you spray this herbicide on around.
Yeah.
Then that was what was covered. It wasn't a composition of matter patent on the plant or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think that was later.
Okay.
But anyway, that, because I remember somebody from the company that licensed it, they went through all the claims and tried to figure out, could we get around them?
Yeah.
Yes.
They came to Tim and they said, well, we couldn't figure out how to get around them, so we have to license it from you.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
That's a quote.
Like, wow,
yes,
exactly what you want.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. Right.
Yeah. I was asking the question because, you know, just thinking about you're trying to mix what you have with what someone else has, because what someone else might have a more productive variety.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand how that would work legally. So now, is it that what you create by crossbreeding is that jointly owned by both parties? And so
yes,
when it's, when that crossbreed is used, you are like, you are partial owner of that new one because you did the crossbreed.
Right. And what it was is that the company, which started out as American Cynomid, that got bought by Bayer first and then BASF, or BASF. Anyway, BASF has it now.
I think BASF bought it. No,
yeah.
Bayer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Bayer, yeah, that was another one. Licensed, and then would make separate license agreements with these other entities.
Okay.
For the seed. And then it was tied to the herbicide. Now, even though this herbicide already existed and was used in soybeans, they had to approve it for it being used on rice. So they had to go through a little bit of thing, which wasn't a big thing since it was already existing herbicide, but they had to get it approved for using on rice. And then they would have these packages that they could go to India and mostly South America and other countries and say, okay, here's, we'll negotiate this license with you. And then LSU had the thing through BASF where, you know, based on the royalties coming in, then they would get so much and then go from there.
Hmm. If you had a broad utility patent on spraying this herbicide around rice, mm-hmm. you would have coverage for all plants, right? So even if you crossbred it,
right,
you would control that, mm-hmm. just that technique.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember reading the patent claims years ago. It's been like mm-hmm. 25 years. I don't remember them, but they'd be interesting to go through. There's a series of patents issued with how the claims evolve. Hmm. Might want to do that at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the crossbreeding go? Was it a relatively easy process to get variety?
Pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Time consuming,
but fun.
How long did it take to get it to work?
Well, normally they would do it like based on the growing season.
Right.
But Tim amped it up to where he was doing it year round in the greenhouse.
Yeah.
You know, because the whole thing was to
get it going.
Get it going and moving it fast. And then you want to describe your little field tours? That was a huge thing there. Do you remember?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So once he had all these breeders from all these places involved and they were all excited about it, and Tim would take their varieties and move that gene in and get to about an F3 level or F4.
Third or fourth
generations mm-hmm. down. He would plant these in the field in rows, and each one was identified by, you know, what its original source of, whether it came from Brazil or India or whatever. And then set it up to where the breeders would now come and over a two-day period, and I think BASF funded the breeders mm-hmm. to come in. And then all his crew and my crew, every breeder was matched up with a technician, and they had a book explaining what all the different rows were, and then they could go through and say, I want seed from this one, I want seed from this one, and the technician would be there to help them if they wanted it from a specific plant in a row, or, you know, didn't matter, and they would work together, and then that breeder then now could take his seed back and expanded and developed the variety, you know, further in his country.
In his own country, yeah.
And it just rapidly got the gene out there into a lot of different countries. Mm-hmm. And it was I just remember that the breeders were pretty excited about it because he did a lot of the initial work of, and it's a process because you make a cross and you use the variety you want to move it into as the mother plant. And mm-hmm. the herbicide resistant is the father. So that when you take the seed off and you spray that seed, you make sure that you're getting actually that something that has the pollen from the herbicide resistant in it. And that it's not just a self, because rice is self-pollinating.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd have to spray that, and then you would pull the ones up that are herbicide resistant and move that forward, do another cross, and just keep that process going. It was pretty labor intensive to get just to that like F3
it's pretty
or
F4. Fun too.
So the breeders were like, yeah, come once a year to Crowley, and we'd have lunch at our camp before.
So you never pushed resistance beyond the first two plants you found? Those two separate mutations, is that the full level of resistance you needed?
I think so.
Yeah. You did a pretty extensive thing with rates and different herbicides that were all within that same class, and they had pretty strong resistance on a lot of...
Didn't need any.
And to his earlier questions, did you just spray the plants once with herbicide and that would kill the normal ones and the mutants would survive, or would you spray it repeatedly?
Maybe repeatedly at that application time. Like go twice, make it half strength, have the mixture be half strength with herbicide, walk one way, turn around, walk back the other way, so you're sure you got at least a half a dose on everything.
So
you
weren't trying to drown them in herbicide.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was, and you did that to try to overcome this occasional wind thing. So you got two shots on goal.
Two shots.
And then, but it was ultimately just one round of spraying that either killed it or didn't kill it.
Exactly.
So to your point, it wasn't like over and over and over
again. Yeah. I just need to know if you wanted to like really make sure that there was you're gonna go swimming. This is gonna become a marshland, right? We're just like you're now in a pool of herbicide. Yeah, I was just curious. So you have the success. You file the patent. The patent is issued. You develop the second. You have the second viable mutation. You have breeders coming in, starting to look at your production. At this point, and so this is mid to late 1990s, with this success, and you'd spent 13 years doing this work to find that one mutation, right?
Yeah.
Does your research, or does the work that you then do from that point change? Are you, because I know that you mentioned like you stopped with the second mutant. Mm-hmm. Are you now just focused on this crossbreeding aspect of things, or are you investigating something else in terms of research?
I keep searching for.
I think you did do a few more rounds and stuff. So Tim retired January 1st, 2005. So you did a few more things. There was some protoplast work you were doing. You had the guy from Ukraine doing some plasma research and kind of winding down a lot of different projects. It was mostly just getting it bred into the, and you had to do a lot of work for the patents, like do a lot of other experiments. So he would go in the lab. I remember you had to do some kind of test on a lot of things. I'm trying to remember what that test was because I think I had retired at that point. But you were going into the lab, and what were you testing? Anyway, he was doing
additional testing.
Yeah, on a lot of things. What were you testing for? Shoot, I can't remember.
More example.
Yeah,
more examples for patents, probably.
Yeah. It had something to do with the patents.
On enablement or something.
And once you found this variety, you had mentioned that starting in the late 1980s, you needed to do more publishing, right, to demonstrate your, and for granting and things like that. Did you publish on this work, or was the patent the publication?
The patent was publication.
Patent was publication.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't report on it if you were going to patent it.
Okay.
Because then it became
public.
Prior.
After the patent's issued or after you filed it, you can do it.
Right.
And did you publish after the patent was issued?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
And what about presenting about the work at conferences?
There was some of that. So, you went a lot of to South America.
Yeah.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
Which was scary because he was going to Colombia, and that's when all the kidnapping was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But the chemical company would bring him down and do presentations and mm-hmm. stuff.
And that, to that point, among academics, not everybody knows that he's the inventor of Clearfield rice. If you say, my brother Tim invented